Love it or hate it, you have to admit that this was rather an addictive week for Brexit, and all eyes were on the Mother of Parliaments. A demonstration of democratic resistance, or an exercise in ego that risked turning Westminster into one gigantic creche, or maybe a little of both. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson went to Parliament and lost.
Order. The eyes to the right, 328. The nose to the left, 301. So the eyes have it. The eyes have it. Unlock.
The eyes have it. The eyes. Well, a no deal Brexit is off the table for now anyway. Boris Johnson has until October the 19th to either pass a deal in Parliament or get MPs to approve a no deal Brexit. If not, it's extension request time until the 31st of January 2020. 21 Tories walked across the floor and lost the whip. Charles Stewart Parnell went viral after a reference from a reclining Jacob Rees-Mogg. And on Wednesday, Morning Ireland brought us the Prime Minister's reaction to that lost vote.
Let me know, no doubt, Mr. Speaker, about the consequences of this vote tonight. It means that Parliament is on the brink of wrecking any deal that we might be able to strike. Control of the negotiations to the EU, and that would mean more dither, more delay and more confusion. And it would mean that the EU themselves would be able to decide how long to keep this country in the EU. And since I refuse to go along with that plan, we are going to have to make a choice, Mr. Speaker. I don't want an election. The public don't want an election. I don't believe the Right Honourable Gentleman wants an election. But if the House votes for this bill tomorrow, the public will have to choose who goes to Brussels on October the 17th to sort this out and take this country forward. Everybody knows that if the Right Honourable Gentleman is the Prime Minister, he will go to Brussels and beg for an extension. He will accept whatever Brussels demands, and we will have years more arguments over Brexit. And by contrast, Mr. Speaker, everyone knows that if this government is in charge and if I go to Brussels, I will go for a deal, and I believe I will get a deal. And we will leave anyway on October the 31st.
Golly, well, all of that was before we had Jeremy Corbyn as a chlorinated chicken, Johnson's own brother resigning from the party, and an election almost certainly on the cards. It's just a matter of time. Well, later that same day on Today with Sean O'Rourke, reporter Barry Linehan brought us the views of Londoners as to a potential general election.
Another election, what do you think?
I think it needs to be done.
What makes you say that?
Well, I believe in Boris. He's not going back to Europe cup in hands. Yeah, allow him. Let's do it. Well, I'm a Brexiteer, so let's do it.
No deal Brexit doesn't bother you?
We need a deal, but Europe won't give us a deal.
Well, there is a deal with a backstop there at the moment.
Well, I was going to say a word, but No. Europe, no. They've been sucking off us for years and years and years. I'm not really into politics, but Boris needs to do it. And he's starting to fix the country already.
On behalf of every single citizen of the United Kingdom, perhaps excluding Northern Ireland, I'm so sorry. To everybody listening to this, I'm so sorry. I know we've done some bad stuff to you, but I know it's really tasted the biscuit. I'm terribly sorry, OK? And listen, we can't really be trusted, and maybe in the end to be first. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry.
Prospect of another election. How does that make you feel?
I'm just dreading it. Dreading it all, to be honest.
Do any of the recent events change your opinion on Brexit?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. I think we should have left. That's what I voted for. So it's just annoying me now that it isn't happening. Because, you know, it's just democracy at the end. I feel that, you know, we had the vote, and it just worries me. If it doesn't happen, I just won't feel like I want to vote again.
And Mr. Johnson, is he for you?
I do think he's good. I think he could be good. But if he's coming at a terrible time. But so, I don't know. And they're all going against him, aren't they? So it's hard to tell what's going to happen.
And that may be the truest word spoken. On Thursday, Sean O'Rourke's intro was a pretty accurate summation of the state of play.
Confusion and uncertainty and brinkmanship continue very much in the air and are very much the order of the day at Westminster this morning as speculation continues about when the next general election will take place.
He spoke to Mary Cray, Labour MP, and Andrew Bridgen, pro-Brexit Conservative MP.
Your own party is splitting because your own people, MPs know, and they have bravely put their own careers and their own livelihoods and their own... to be expelled from their party because they know what your Prime Minister is doing is not in the national interest. He's a brand new Prime Minister. He's lost all four of his first votes. He is weak. He knows he's on the ropes. We've got him on the ropes and we're going to keep him there.
We've got a Parliament stacked out with Remain supporting MPs who do not represent the country. And if you go to a general election, you're going to lose, and that's what you're chicking
but
about.
The point about it is, though, Andrew Bridgen, is that it would appear that a sizeable number of your own party, or former members, as they are now having lost the whip, and indeed the combined opposition, want to see the colour of Boris Johnson's money where these negotiations are concerned. And we're hearing from Brussels that the negotiations are
there's
in a state of...
There's going to be no negotiations.
Why is he talking...
Boris Johnson does not want to negotiate.
Well, he can't negotiate because the EU are not going to give us any concessions because you've taken our negotiating position off the table with others in Parliament.
Blame someone else.
And the Project Fear lies are all unravelling. Simon Coveney has admitted there will be no hard border on the island of Ireland. The Czechs will be taken away from the border, even in the event of a no-deal Brexit, something we've been saying for the last year and has been completely rubbished by the Remainers.
Which is true. Does the Prime Minister want to negotiate a new deal or does he want no deal?
He's got nothing to negotiate with because you've handcuffed him that we can't leave without a deal.
If no deal's not going to be a problem for our country, why would having it as an ace card to play in the European negotiations be so frightening for the Europeans, Andrew? You can't have it both ways. It can't be not a problem for our country and a massive problem for Europe.
Well, they sell us £100 billion, Mary, more than we sell to them. We're the customer. And also, they want the £39 billion of the
so-called... Our medicines, our vaccines, our national security, our economy... all put at risk so that the posh boys in the Tory party can save their bacon from Nigel Farage's Brexit party. What a sorry state the Conservatives
are in. Well,
Mary,
actually, I went to a comprehensive school and lived in a house that didn't have mains electricity to age 11. I don't think I'm one of
the posh
boys.
You're an honourable exception, Andrew.
My constituency voted by 61% to leave the European Union. They've noticed that you're damaging our democracy, that 3.5 years after... the biggest democratic exercise we've ever had in our country, we haven't left the European Union.
Andrew Bridgen, I'd like to...
This is a crisis of democracy.
Fractured is not the word, and all the while Prime Minister Johnson smack bang in the eye of the storm and Jeremy Corbyn swirling around. Well, on Thursday evening, Drive Time, Sarah McInerney got the view of Shadow Minister for Northern Ireland, Stephen Pound.
We are seriously in absolutely unprecedented territory. And I'm seeing people sort of walking around with glazed looks in their eyes, or walking into the walls and things, because people just don't know what's going on. Their lordships are meeting again. We'll have a situation on Monday. On Monday, we've got a whole day of Northern Ireland business. We've got Northern Ireland statutory instruments on Tuesday. We've got Northern Ireland questions on Wednesday. All that business is occupying my mind rather more than sort of fancy footwork and sneaky shenanigans over dates.
Well, everybody else is looking at the dates, I think, Stephen. And looking at what is likely to happen. So if Jeremy Corbyn doesn't opt for the general election option on Monday and doesn't give Boris Johnson what he's looking for, what happens then? Because Boris Johnson is still saying there's no way he's going to ask for an extension come October 31st. At the same time, Michael Gove is saying that he will honour the legislation if it's passed and there will be no-deal Brexit. So if there's no-deal Brexit and there's no extension, what happens on October 31st?
Yeah, I wish you hadn't asked me that question. the reality of the situation is that if their lordships actually send back a bill as amended, as we anticipate they now will, which actually takes the no deal off the table, then quite clearly we're in a very, very difficult position because there's a kind of Anglo-Saxon assumption here that there are people in Brussels and Strasbourg longing to accommodate our every change of mind and our every sort of different perspective on this. The reality is the EU27 are pretty fed up with us at the present time.
Just how fed up, I wonder? Well, way, way back on Tuesday, Mary Wilson spoke to Europe editor Tony Connolly.
During his speech earlier today, Boris Johnson said there is now real momentum in the talks with Brussels. Is that what you're hearing from your contacts there?
No, it's the reverse, in fact, Mary. And actually, the European Commission has been on record 2 days in a row at their midday briefing that while there have been technical meetings between David Frost, who's Boris Johnson's chief negotiator, and the European Commission Task Force, the UK have not put forward any concrete proposals. And that was reduced to the word zilch from a well-connected source I spoke to this afternoon.
That was Tuesday, but surely by Thursday things would have moved on just a little. Staying with Drive Time and Sarah McInerney, she spoke to Belgian MEP Philippe Lambert, who sits on the EU Parliament's Brexit Task Force. Not a man to mince his words.
And Philippe, there's been good news from Downing Street today because a spokesman is saying that negotiations with Brussels are continuing today and that they're constructive negotiations.
Oh, really?
Well, yes, that's what he's saying.
I was not aware of this, and this is not the story I'm hearing in Brussels, but I guess that Boris Johnson is to keep the illusion. There's not been serious negotiations since he became prime minister, because actually he doesn't want negotiations. He wants a no-deal Brexit, and now I really wonder why there should be real negotiations since we are dealing with a government that is devoid of a majority.
So you're saying that, in your view, there has been no real negotiations since Boris Johnson
came in? No, because, well, you know pretty well what the crux of the issue is, and that's the Irish situation. And since Boris Johnson has made a profession of getting rid of the Irish backstop without proposing any alternative, well, we are in a deadlock.
Do you think he wants a deal?
No, absolutely not. I think that he pursues a strategy of a no-deal Brexit, and I think that all his actions so far demonstrate this.
And then yesterday, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar addressed the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce and grudgingly conceded that maybe, just maybe, a no-deal Brexit might happen. And should it come to pass, we need to get ready.
A no-deal Brexit will have an adverse effect on our economy. It'll cause economic growth to slow, but the economy will still grow. We do not anticipate a return to recession. Unemployment will rise, but total employment will also continue to rise, albeit at a slower rate. So while jobs will be lost, more jobs again will be created, but just not at the same rate. The public finances we anticipate will go from surplus to deficit, but a deficit of less than 2%, which is better than our long-run average. We do not anticipate pay cuts, income tax increases, our overall reductions in public spending. There will be no return to austerity. We will not need to take that trip again.
Oh, the whole thing is like the ultimate bad trip. Well, Morning Ireland's Audrey Carvel got the views of RTE's Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
Tommy, any reaction there or thoughts on these latest comments by Leo Varadkar last night that there may have to be checks near the border in the event of a no-deal Brexit?
Audrey, I was surprised by the notion that senior members of the cabinet would be surprised by the severity of what might take place in the event of a hard Brexit. I think if you look back to comments that Mary McAleese made in Edinburgh, I think 2 years ago, she foresaw what was likely to happen in the event of a hard Brexit. Ireland, as part of the European Union, will have to try to protect the integrity of the single market. And if Boris Johnson's administration looks to break all ties in terms of regulatory alignment and to be as independent a trading nation as possible, I think the kind of checks that are being discussed are inevitable in terms of a hard border. I'd watch for next Monday in particular to see what Boris Johnson outlines when he comes to meet the Taoiseach. Remember, there's a vote of no confidence in the House of Commons later that day. And Boris Johnson at the moment, he's torn between two arguments. If he goes with the hard Brexiteers, he has to try and make as total a break as possible. On the other hand, if he looks to accommodate the One Nation Tories within his party, and indeed the DUP, who don't want a hard Brexit, who want a sensible Brexit, well, then he starts to look at what might be possible in grey areas. And I think it's because of that that the European Union and the Irish government are holding fire on publishing what would be definitive proposals. Because until you know what kind of Brexit Boris Johnson is going to pursue, you can't put your proper infrastructure in place.
So, Prime Minister Johnson here on Monday. Well, there endeth the Brexit for this week. There was a distinctly agrarian theme to much of this week's radio. First up, seagulls.
It's like open warfare.
That's Dublin resident Frank MacDonald, columnist and writer, talking to Seanan Rourke. Now, Frank was once a fan of a stroll in Stephen's Green, but no more.
The ducks and moorhens are in the background, almost scared to come near you, whereas in the foreground and all over the place are the seagulls and some pigeons as well. And any time somebody produces a bag of crusts or whatever, they just descend on the thing and then fight with each other over who gets what.
And how have they destroyed or at least disturbed your tranquility?
They do screech and squawk at all hours of the day and night. And particularly in the early morning, about 3 o'clock onwards. But also, there's something very aggressive about them. They're scavengers, obviously. There seems to be no way of controlling them.
Now, Frank wants a cull, although he admits he doesn't know quite how this might work. Enter wildlife expert and fellow Dublin resident, Aina Ní Leabhar.
It's like the Planet of the Apes, isn't it? It's the same with the gulls. The gulls were a grand species, living out in Lambay Island, minding their own business, nesting on the cliffs, feeding on fish. The clue is in the name, herring gull. And now, look what's happened. Because we, a human species, have destroyed where they live, destroyed their food, and we have made our city a wonderful habitat for them. And the gulls are not eager, so they've moved in, and we don't like it. We're getting a taste of our own medicine for a change. Now, to understand him, this has to be done in a scientific fashion. How did this species, which in the 1990s was so actually reduced by 90% that it's on the conservation list, the red list of conservation of species in birds in Ireland. How did it get from that to this? And it's because of human behaviour. So there's no point in killing gulls, there's no point in doing this. We have to see what we are doing in Dublin that's encouraging them to do it. Now, what do birds need? Birds need food and birds need somewhere to live. And they're getting both of those things in spades in Dublin. But the gulls in particular are a long-living bird, so it's 4 years before they breed. Now, normally the gulls that were one and two and three, the teenage gangs, would go off to the sea, but these lot were never at the sea in their lives. So they're all hanging around as well, looking for food, not even breeding or anything else. And the population of the gulls in Dublin is increasing and impacting on...
And Aina wants to hammer home the point because it is us human beings that have created these seagull monsters. Back to Stephen's Green.
You go any of these places now, there's signs up saying do not feed the ducks. And yet people with sliced pans, not just a few crumbs, Frank, sliced pans, they're flinging them in. So the ducks had burst if they ate all that. And of course the rats are eating it and the gulls are eating it and then the rats are eating the ducks' eggs. So like we have not obeyed the laws of ecology and the chickens, or in this case the gulls, have come home to roost. What do we expect? A clever species that's taken this on at her own game and are annoying us. We do it to spiders, we do it to all the birds and they just quietly go away and die. But these lot are coming back. The Planet of the Apes, I'm telling you.
Aina wants investment to do a nest survey and go from there. And Frank, well, he just wants it all to stop.
We now have to wash their guano, as it were, off our windows because for
that's
some
a very polite word.
Well, that there may be sensitive people listening to the programme.
And it's not just the guano Frank can't stand. He wants the noise to stop, the squawking sounds of seagull pleasure.
And how noisy does it get when they're copulating?
Well, I mean to say, you know, it depends on where you're coming from. I mean, do we listen to people copulating? I mean, this is kind of a very personal kind of a question. But they enjoy themselves and they want to make sure...
Frank, can you enlighten us on this?
Yeah.
No, not really. He doesn't know
what they're at. He hears the noise. He doesn't look out to see what they're doing.
Ooh, the sound of nervous laughter. That was Frank MacDonald and Aina Ní Leabhar with Seanan O'Rourke. And over on The Ray Darcy Show, they're doing a Moo cover. Yes, a Moo cover. Here are hair and beauty specialists Olive and James.
Let me break it down for you. We have these two big, beautiful heifers that we are going to make look and feel fantastic. Cows, it takes it to a whole new level.
It does. Right.
But we're open for the challenge. Like, okay. We have had so much fun.
Have you met Diamond?
I've met Diamond. We have had a connection.
Like, right, okay.
There's something about this cow. We're in it to win it.
But I've just got a manicure done on my nails. I don't know how this is going to go down. Seriously, guys. I just got a file and polish.
Oh, well, no, I have a full set.
You'll be fine, yeah.
Full set of acrylics on these bad boys. So listen, Diamond, you need to take it easy with me.
All of which might well have appealed to Benji, although far be it for me to stereotype. But Benji the Little Gay Bull was the documentary on One this week, and it was hilarious and strangely moving. Back in 2014, farmer Joe Kelly from Kelchimaw, County Mayo, had bought a bull to service his cows, a fine bull for which he had the highest of hopes.
Hello, girls. That's a bull saying, I'd love to have a nice time with you, darling. Would it be all right?
Oh, and it was more than all right with her, downright frisky, in fact. But this bull wasn't playing ball.
Then I seen a cow coming on heat, but he wasn't near them. But I still didn't think that was that unusual, because often bulls are very discreet. You won't see them serving the cow. That's one of the feeds that I saw that he wasn't bulling the cows. I watched him. Well, he never went near. In fact, the farther away he could be from her, the better it suited him. I said, what the hell is that fella doing? I kept him thinking, maybe he's too young, maybe he's going to get the idea yet, maybe things will come around. But that spring, there were 7 cows here with him. And after he was with them for 3 months, none of them were in calf. But I knew then he hadn't gone near any of them. Girls, we'll see you later. Have a pleasant evening, Litchie.
However, it wasn't that Benji was more interested in settling in with a good book. No, he had the glad eye for the buchli, and it was clearly fellow bulls that turned his head. Well, when Joanna McNicholas broke the story in the Connacht Telegraph, the bull became known as Benji, the gay bull, who might just face the slaughterhouse for his lack of performance. The story grew legs and a campaign to save Benji was started. Here's animal rights activist and gay man, John Carmody.
I remember being in school when I was a young kid. I was gay at the time and I remember being often on my own in the yard. Didn't have anyone to look out for me. And maybe I connected with the plight of Benji. Maybe I seen that he too wants to be loved and cared for and respected.
And John wanted to buy the bull. But Joe Kelly pointed out the practicalities of this rescue mission.
I remember sitting at the end of the phone thinking, is this guy in the real world at all? And I said, was the last burger he ate, was it a gay burger or a straight burger? What? I said, for goodness sake, I said, most animals are killed before we know their sexual orientation. Well, that's where the unfairness is. If just because he's gay, so he's going to be shot. I could see his argument. He had an argument, but he deemed that he was entitled to a full life as a gay bull. Why should he be abused more than a heterosexual bull? I said, I'm not waiting too long, John. I'm long enough fed up looking at this bull and he's doing nothing for me. And he said, well, I'd see what I can do. I have other ideas and plans. I said, you better put them in place. Don't let the bull die. Don't let the butcher near the bull. That was his big concern.
Benji, no burger here, please. Well, through a mix of crowdfunding and the involvement of Sam Simon, co-founder of the TV show The Simpsons, listen back for that detail, Benji was saved. And not only was he saved, he was living a very full life.
That's him. Look at his head and his curly kind of bob.
Oh, he's grown out of his curls, which is a bit sad. But it happens to some lads, you know. They grow out of their curls.
Benji is not alone in this field. There's another male animal near him, Bernie. Bernie was also saved from the slaughterhouse after his owner found out he was sterile.
So he's the one that was firing blanks, is he?
That's the one.
It can happen. To men or beast.
But wasn't he lucky he ended up here as well?
Horrid lucky to the known world. Do they know how lucky they are?
These bulls have been saved.
Benji is rambling over towards Bernie. He's making some communication with Bernie. They're definitely friends. Look at now. Now there's a picture. They're quick. Benji is smelling the end of Bernie. But he's so happy.
He is so happy,
so
isn't
happy.
He?
Look at him.
Oh, and there's a place for us all. That was Benji the Little Gay Bull, the doc on One from Joanna McNicholas and Nicolene Greer last Saturday. And back to Ray Darcy for a finish.
We said we'd play a little bit of this because of me on the New Holland Combine Harvester yesterday. Just a little bit, not all of it. Just a little bit of it.
I drove my tractor through your haggard last night. I threw me pitchfork at your dog to keep quiet. Now something's telling me that you're avoiding me. Come on now, girlie, you've got something I need. Well, I've got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. Come on now, let's live together in perfect harmony. I've got 20 acres and you've got 43. Well, I've got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. Will you come down off that cocky here and listen?
Oh, I heard you singing along to it. Couldn't help yourself, could you? Welcome back.
Now, to pee or not to pee, that is the question. Or rather, the question should be to pee or not to pee in public. Pat
had been at the Fla in Drogheda last month.
My daughter said, "Mam, look behind you." And I just turned around and this woman had walked into the store with two children, one girl about 8 or 9 and a guy 4 or 5, put them behind the door, full view, glass, you know, glass doors, glass windows, and the little guy was peeing there, peeing against the window and down onto a fire extinguisher. And I said, "Oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it."
Sorry, you're saying the child was inside in the store?
Yes. Peeing in the store, brought
up against the window from the inside out?
Yes, I couldn't believe it.
Well, the floodgates opened, so to speak. Lack of public toilets, various medical needs that requested access to the loo, and the perils of being caught short, which turned out to be the euphemism of choice. And then Jane from Adair in County Limerick phoned in, and her story upped the ante considerably.
I tell a boy that I came down my garden one morning to do some work, to found that some human being had decided to treat it as a toilet and defecated near my glass house. So my property borders the local park, and when I brought it to the attention of the local authority, they questioned me as to how I knew that it was human rather than a dog or a cat. And I said, "I've yet to meet a dog or a cat that wipes his rear and leaves the paper after it."
Oh my God. So you're saying was there the offending poo, we'll call it,
yes,
but there was actually the toilet paper with it.
Yes, indeed.
And this wasn't her family's first encounter of this kind.
We had a little sandpit at the back of our house just to play in. Mm-hmm. And we frequently found busloads of tourists relieving themselves in the same sandpit. So my mother had to post a notice on the front of the cottage to state that the rear of those houses were not public toilets, which brought the local authority running fairly fast because the tourists were having a great time taking photographs of the notice. So that was resolved by opening public toilets.
Was that what actually got the public toilets into Adair in the first place?
That actually got the public toilets. So I don't know what's left for me to do to stop people defecating in my garden.
And ever the investigative journalist Katie Hannan asked this.
"And come here, what did you do with the offending item that you found in your garden?"
I took some photos in case nobody believed me. And I got a little shovel and I buried it. What more could I do? I mean, I could hardly preserve it. So it has been a pleasure talking to you, but I have to get back to my garden.
The pleasure is all ours, Jane. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Remarkable good humour there, and possibly a very well fertilised garden. That was Jane in Limerick on Liveline. On Monday, Fine Tuberty spoke to the governor of Mountjoy Prison, Eddie Mullins, and he asked him how important class is when it comes to the prison population.
"You could count on two hands the amount of people in prison that are middle class."
"No, but that's without drugs, just all told."
"Yeah, all told."
"So
out
of 700, let's call it white collar, blue collar."
"Okay, well, I can think in the last year, I can think of two people who I met coming into prison who were from a middle class background and the crime was drug related. They're the only two that can come to mind."
"And how many people out of the 700 roughly in Mountjoy Prison would you say characterise as middle class?"
"I would say 96% of the prison population statistically would say come from a poorer background. So 4% of the prison population are middle class. And you have to look into the context of sex offenders, for example, make up a certain percentage of the prison population. And sex offenders are From all backgrounds.
96% versus 4%. Yeah. What are we to make of that, of those figures?
And Ryan put forward two quite different points of view when it comes to crime and criminals.
Right wing, left wing, right? Mm-hmm. You know where I'm going with this. Yeah. So half of them are saying, lock them up. If you steal, you pay the price. If you do drugs, if you deal drugs, you get the hell behind bars and, you know, hair shirt. And the other half go, well, if they have to, you know, understand where they're coming from, that they're committing a crime for a reason, that they're probably, you know, you just mind them, nurture them and bring them out and try and make them. It's an age old argument.
And Eddie Mullins could see both sides of those arguments.
There are quite a significant number of prisoners who have no interest in rehabilitation, who make serious money out of crime. They will come into prison and do their time and go back out and resume their criminal activities.
Yes.
But there are a lot of people in the system who are, you know, given the right opportunities and supports. And, you know, the whole notion of rehabilitation, I would describe rehabilitation really as a recovery programme. Mm. So in the prison service, for example, we have a lot of programmes to deal with addiction, to deal with mental health issues. We provide fantastic education and training programmes. But that's really only the start of it. You know, when prisoners leave prison, and almost all prisoners will leave prison at some stage, then it's really over to society to step in and to continue with that rehabilitation and recovery programme. And a lot of prisoners will tell you when they leave prison that, you know, they feel ostracised, they feel that they are not welcome back.
Stigmatised,
yeah. Totally. Yeah. And then, so the natural progression for these guys is back to the people that they feel comfortable with, yeah, who welcomed them back. So it's a really vicious circle.
Governor of Mountjoy Prison Eddie Mullins with Ryan on Monday. On Wednesday, Ray Darcy spoke to comedian and now actor Willie White, who is performing in a play called The Examination, which explores lives of prisoners in Mountjoy, an experience of which he has first-hand knowledge.
I was basically threw in at the deep end, and they said to me, do you know anyone in here? And I said, I do. So I knew this guy, so he took me up and put me on his floor. And I'd never been in a cell before in my life, and I walked up onto the landing and I just seen this big, big old Victorian building, and it was very overwhelming. And the one thing I always remember about the place was the smell of it. It was just a horrible, horrible smell. It was a stink. Because when I went to prison, there was a slopping out system in Mountjoy, which meant there was no toilets and there was no wash basins in, you know, no sinks in the cell. So it's a piece in the play, actually, that I talk about my experience. I just never forget that smell. Like going down every morning and emptying out your piss pot and washing it, and then being there some mornings brushing your teeth and guys coming down beside you late and throwing theirs down, and the smell of bins in that area. I mean, in that one area, in the slopping out area, you emptied your piss pot, you washed, you went to the toilet, and you emptied your bins. So it was that whole thing. I think even if I got Alzheimer's, God forbid, all harm in years to come, if that smell was put in front of me, I'd always know where it came from.
He managed to quit drugs at the age of 29 in a cell number, also 29. And coming back full circle, what did he think about rehabilitation in prison?
You get a lot of people saying that it's a holiday camp, like. It's listen, come here. The Butlins don't lock you up at 7 o'clock in the evening, And you know, that's society, and that's what people will say. Your punishment is that you're taken away from the people that you love. You're locked up. Your privileges is taken away. Your freedom is taken away.
Yeah. And but you have committed a crime.
Yes, without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. And I'm not, you know, here kind of, like, the play is kind of about, it's about the welfare, and it is about the treatment of prisoners. Mm. The sentence is the sentence, but sometimes the conditions don't meet the criteria.
Looking back at your life, Willie, now, what, you know, the what ifs? What if you were born in Foxrock as opposed to Ballymun?
I don't know, but you know what? I'm not. Come here. I've met people from really nice areas and people who were brought up with really nice parents. Mm. And I mean, addiction.
But they're in our prisons. They're in the minority.
Of course, without a shadow of a
single percentage.
Yes,
single percentage figures.
Yeah, they come here. Listen, they get a better chomp at it, you know, than we do, you know. But addiction doesn't care where you come from.
Willie White with Ray Darcy. Well, Kerry, versus Dublin. It is not over yet, not by a long shot. Game On's Marie Crowe gauged reaction to the big match from Alan Cawley on Monday.
Brilliant atmosphere, brilliant occasion, but the game itself, probably not the most skillful game I ever watched, but loads of incident, loads of drama, loads of tension, which added to the whole kind of... I suppose the finale, the way it finished up as well. I felt at halftime, the 15-15, that if it had to stay like that, that Dublin would have went on and won, because even though Curry had such a brilliant start and they created lots of chances and cut the penalty save, obviously, that they missed, the one cleared off the line. Clifford missed two or three as well that you'd never expect them to miss. And then Dublin got into their stride and started to take over and take some of their chances. And you're looking at it coming up to halftime, and there was a gap of 5 points, I think it was, before Johnny Cooper got sent off. And I'm thinking the writing's on the wall here, and everybody was probably thinking that. Yeah. Then the sending off happened. I think it gave Curry a boost as well. But to be fair to Dublin, all the analysis I've read today and listened to and heard, it seems to be obviously Curry have been great, and it was great for the spectacle of it that they showed up, because everybody wanted that. I didn't give them a prayer, as I said to you on Friday. But I think people are forgetting the fact that Dublin, for all their brilliance, and we praise them for all that, the resilience they showed to play for 40 minutes with 14 men was unbelievable as well. And obviously kept them in it, because at 55 minutes, they were five up as well. And if Paddy Small's one goes over, that's 6 points. And the small margins, they go down the pitch then and get the goal, and it gives them life, it gives them hope. They're back in it, Curry. And it looked like then Curry had the momentum to go on and win it. And Dublin were hanging on there for a little spell. It was just amazing. It was brilliant. And we get to do it all again in 2 weeks.
Keep the flags unfurled and make up the sandwiches, because it is all to play for. Over on Arena, Sean Rocks was talking to actor Stanley Townsend about his upcoming run in Paul Muldoon's Incantata. But Stanley also talked about working in London, and frankly, keep an eye on your tootsie toes for these next few clips. A hell of a lot of names are dropped. First up, Judi Dench.
She was wonderful, though. She's so, so welcoming, and after about 5 minutes, you're just in. We call her the dude. She used to do the dude Dench. She used to do the Daily Telegraph crossword. So myself and Anna McLean decided we'd take her on. So we started getting the Telegraph and doing the crossword, the cryptic, to try and get it done before her. She'd come into the dressing room and she'd just fling it down and say, "There you go, boys." And we never, ever got it done before she did. She used to carry a big bunch of keys, almost like the porter from Macbeth, huge thing. And I looked at it one day and I said to her, "Dude, what's all the keys? What's the story?" And she said, "These two are from my house. The rest is if anyone tries to mug me, I can hit them with it. It's a legal weapon." So there's steel in the dude.
Then Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah, I ended up in a hot tub with Sacha Baron Cohen, and he was magnificent, really. And I was a Syrian general, and he was playing a Jewish spy. I, of course, didn't know he was an Israeli. We played lots of scenes together and had a great time in Budapest and Morocco.
And finally, he tread the boards with Christian Slater in Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet.
Yeah, I had a wonderful time with Christian. We had this thing where Shelley was telling a big, long story to Christian's character, and he said, I had to eat her crumb cake. And Christian's line was, "You had to eat her crumb cake." And Christian did it in such a way, and he just gave me the eyebrows, "You had to eat her crumb cake." And the house just erupted. I suppose there may have been a double entendre there. I don't know. I don't know if Mamet intended it, but... And then
Christian Slater intended it.
He sure did. He wouldn't come in with the next line, because he just kept looking at me and nodding, and the house just kept laughing and laughing and laughing. And Christian would just surf that laughter until they died away, and then he'd come in with the next line all the time, knowing I was on the rack.
Hobnail boots on for that one. What a life. That was Stanley Townsend with Sean Rocks on Arena. American Vice President Mike Pence visited Ireland at the start of the week. Wine kind of summed it up.
Has he gone? "Thanks, Mike. Thanks for nothing." He's gone after a... Or is he still floating around? If he's still here. "Oh, thanks for coming and for backing Boris Johnson in Ireland."
Oh, cheeky. And we mentioned the B-man. Sorry. Well, second captain spoke to Colm Tobin for their final programme of the season. And Colm responded to a recent controversy he had generated when he said he can't do thrillers and can't do spy novels. In fact, he says, "I can't do any genre fiction." Well, the genre writers came for him, and the crime ones in particular had their knives out.
They always have the last laugh, in a sense, because they're the ones whose books sell.
I mean, nobody buys my books. And everyone's always buying crime and saying you should read this new crime book. So, but they're obviously very sensitive. They're alone in a room. And they all got really, really, really upset.
Snobbery.
I couldn't stop laughing.
Snobbery and intellectual arrogance. Those were the main. Oh, yeah. It's time for, Sheila O'Fallon says, it's time for people like Cullum to step outside the hallowed halls of academia and widen his horizons.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to the World Cup. Is that not good enough?
Maybe so. But later in the interview, Cullum Dobbin gave a more nuanced and interesting answer as to why certain writing appealed to him and why crime writing just simply didn't have that.
I just couldn't find something that I need in a novel to get me going, which is a sort of underlying rhythm in the prose that holds you emotionally. It just doesn't do that for me. It probably does it for Sheila O'Flanagan, and, you know, it's great that she's reading crime.
So what is that, though, when you talk about rhythm? I mean, what does that really...
I think it's the basic thing when you're writing that you're not merely giving information, and that underneath the sentences, in between them, in between the words, in the way the sentences are placed there, there's a sound, there's a melody, there's something that holds you emotionally, which is not the information being given in the actual, you know, words with their dictionary meaning. In other words, that just say the words have a soul as well as a body. In other words, the body will be the information, but the soul will be the sound. The soul will be something in the way the words hit against each other. So when you talk about someone who writes well, you're talking about that idea of something in the rhythm being there that can hold you. And obviously it happens for some people and not others. It's strange because it can happen in a translation as much as in an original. So you know, it's very, very hard to pinpoint. And it may be that something in your DNA gets stirred or gets hit emotionally by something on the page. And it's entirely personal. In other words, some book that's a crime novel or a chick lit novel, say, even though those categories are very, very hard to be sure about, but just say, could hit somebody emotionally and wouldn't hit somebody else, including me. So it just depends on you as the reader. But it's absolutely essential. If it isn't there, then you get nothing at all from the page.
But finally, when it comes to his sport, tennis, he has his own particular rhythm.
I play a dull, slow game. No double faults, no winners. I can't even place the ball. I just hit it back all the time in a slow, methodical sort of way. I drive people nuts. I lob a lot. I slow the game down a lot. I'm an absolute nightmare. I often win because the other person just gets so bored.
People must
so
hate you.
Tedious. Yes, I am a tedious person.
Wearing them down, that was Cullum Dobbin on Second Captains. Let's finish with a little nod to our EU friends. Here's some Europop.
So heiß wie ein Vulkan. Und heute verbrenne ich mich daran. Jedermann nennt dich Sweet Lady Samba. Jeder sieht, dass du kein Kind mehr bist. Die bunten Lichter drehen sich wie Feuer, wenn du die Welt ringsumher vergisst. Du bist so heiß wie ein Vulkan. Und heute verbrenne ich mich daran. Rock'n'Roll, Cha-Cha-Bam und der Boogie, das ist jetzt alles für mich vorbei. Die ganze Welt tanzt heute die Samba. Ole, ole, wir sind dabei. Tanze Samba mit mir. Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht. Tanze Samba mit mir. Weil die Samba uns glücklich macht. Liebe, Liebe, Liebelei. Morgen ist sie vielleicht vorbei. Tanze Samba mit mir. Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht. Du bist so heiß wie ein Vulkan. Und heute verbrenn ich mich daran. Tanze Samba mit mir. Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht. Tanze Samba mit mir. Weil die Samba uns glücklich macht. Liebe, Liebe, Liebelei. Morgen ist sie vielleicht vorbei. Tanze Samba mit mir. Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht. Du bist so heiß wie ein Vulkan. Und heute verbrenn ich mich daran. Tanze Samba mit mir. Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht, tanze Samba mit mir, weil die Samba uns glücklich macht. Liebe, Liebe, Liebelei, morgen ist sie vielleicht vorbei. Tanze Samba mit mir, Samba, Samba die ganze Nacht.
Rock'n'Roll Cha-Cha Boogie, that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.